where we talk about safety, survival, and other things. Welcome to the Backstep.
Oh, he says it twice, the guy. I like that. Welcome to the Backstep. Yeah, what he said. Welcome to the Backstep, everybody. A very happy, healthy, and safe new year to all of you. From Tommy and I'm sure Tommy will give you his greetings. This is Ronnie Kay. I'm in chilly New York State. And Tommy, what's going on out there in New Mexico?
It is a chilly evening here, but it actually warmed up to about 36 today, and the sun was shining. And all was well here on the western part of the world.
Huh. We're having similar weather. It's in the high 30s, low 40s here, and we did have a bang of a snowstorm a week before Christmas. We got 2 feet of, I live north of the city. We got about 2 feet overnight. It was coming hot and heavy, so we're hoping. You know, my wife keeps saying, "Well, that's it for the season. We had our snow. That's it. We're done." You know, she's hoping.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know, but. Last night we had 2 inches of fresh powder, but it went away today. It got up in around 40 and it's gone. So I don't mind when it comes at night and it's so pretty and then it's gone the next day. You know, so well, let the good Lord. Like you know, I said about we guys talk about shoveling. You know, so I knew a guy who was funny as I was an old timer. He said, "You know what? With the snow, God put it there. God will take it away. I don't need to bother with it." You know, so that there's a little bit of wisdom there, right? A little bit of wisdom.
Oh, absolutely. God. Well, you know my theory on having to shovel all that global warming out of the driveway.
Exactly. I remember the first time you called me up and said this. You called me up and said, "Quote unquote." I called Al Gore and told him to shovel 2 feet of global warming out of my driveway, if I remember that right. But
yes.
What the hell? Shit. So what's, you know, we haven't seen a lot lately, Tom, but what's going on with the Western wildfire scene? What is there, you know, something flared up the other day. I think it was California, not sure. But what's going on with the wildfires out west?
You know, it's been kind of a non-news event. There's been a couple of larger incidents further into this year. You know, for years we've always talked about the wildland fire season. And when is that? Well, it's turning into a year-round event now. The seasonal designation doesn't really serve it anymore. It's just such a wacky deal with you know, and I joke about it, but we come back to the global warming thing. And even though experts will probably tell me I'm an idiot, I think it does have some impact on what we're seeing, especially with fires this late in the season and the fire growth in general.
Well, just for the record, Tom, I'm no expert, but I'll be glad to call you an idiot anytime, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing.
What was the calendar designation for the wildfire season in the West?
You know, typically we saw stuff starting to happen probably late May into June, and then you know we kind of got a rainy season. In August, and depending on how much moisture we got, the season would actually continue into September and October and may not let up until the snows hit. California, I remember somebody told me the good news is that the mudslides put the fires out. You know, you used to be able to say, all right, you know, we're in late fall, early winter, we're not going to get anything, but it's just not true anymore.
Interesting. And I know, I think, was this the worst wildfire year, 2020? Was it like the worst year we ever had with the numbers of acres? And
I'm thinking it's got to be close. 2019 with, you know, the car fire that happened and all the rest of the fires that occurred in California were pretty bad. And I think this year pretty much mirrored what we were seeing with that type of stuff. And again, the problem tends to be in those wildland urban interface areas. You know, people expect the fire department to be able to do something with that. And with the size and the rate of spread with what we're seeing out there in the woods, no, it's a force of nature. It's something that can't really be stopped until you get a bunch of resources on scene.
You know, sometimes when it was in the hype, my wife would say to me, "How come they can't get it out?" You know, and I'd say to her, I said that the fire dynamics involved with that much fuel, and then add the winds to it and the dryness and all. I said it's a storm. I said it's like trying to stop a hurricane. You just can't.
Yeah.
There's not enough water. There's not enough people. There's not enough anything. It's got to almost run its course, you know. And pretty sad. Pretty sad. We lost a couple of guys this year in a wildland, like we do every year.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. I really don't.
Well, you know, I don't know whether you're going to stop the problem, but we need to get out of the way of the problem and creating defensible space around your homes in the wildland are certainly one of those. And if you're putting in subdivisions, you may want to think about water. You know, one of my favorite Brunacini quotes is that, you know, fire is really just pure physics. And the only thing the fire is going to understand is the proper application of the required fire flow to solve the problem. And there's a reason why they're called the laws of physics and not the suggestions of physics.
One of my favorite Brunacini quotes, the laws of physics, not the suggestions of physics. But, you know, again, the man was right, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, win, lose, or draw. Not everybody was a Brunacini fan out there. I was. I mean, for years, I had great conversations with Alan. You know, at FDIC, that's where I'd see him. I went out to Phoenix in the '90s when you know Phoenix was running their annual command seminars and stuff. The fact that I met Bobby Halton out there—that's the first time I met. He was still with Albuquerque when I met him. He was the ops chief in Albuquerque when I met Bobby, and. Sure enough, you know, just Alan said and did a lot of things that people were thinking about doing, and he did them. You know, you know, Phoenix always seemed to pioneer. They were in a good spot, and he was in a good spot because he became chief when the city was just starting to grow, and he was there through the housing explosion and all that stuff. So he was in a terrific place and time to get things done and done the right way, you know, from the ground up. So, he certainly left his legacy, but left us all with a little bit of a template on how to do certain things, which is kind of cool, And just, you know, when you sat and talked to the man, as you did many times and I did, never not too busy to sit and chat, not too big, not too. I mean, the man he was built of humble. You know, he was just all 100% humble and a big heart to boot, and just loved the business. You know, he's a guy who just loved the business. You know,
I laugh because he was an Albuquerque boy, and
is that right?
Born and raised. And went to Phoenix because the Albuquerque Fire Department wouldn't hire him.
Is that right?
Yes.
I never heard that. That's interesting. Did he tell you why?
No. And I think it was just part of the testing process.
Oh, okay.
So
gotcha.
He ended up going further west.
Well, he wasn't tall, and back then in the '50s when he got hired, they might have still had a height requirement. You know,
a lot of places
had height requirements, including New York City. Up until the '70s, so you know, it could have been that he wasn't tall enough. But anyway, he did pretty well despite that, right?
You know, I laugh about that because one of the guys I have coffee with in the morning, Steve Guattari, did 30 plus years here in Farmington, and he's a little bitty guy, But I kept thinking a good truck officer, aside from trying to create a company of monsters, needs that one little guy to get in the areas where the other guys don't fit.
Well, that's true. That's true. Think of, you know, especially now, you know, in the last 30 years, we talk about confined spaces. You know, you can't get a guy who's 6'10", 290 into that little tiny space. So there is something to be said about the little guys, right?
Yes.
I agree.
I was perusing today and noticed that NIOSH had sent out a fact sheet and a new poster on fighting row house fires.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, it's something that obviously is where I'm at now. We don't deal with at all. But, you know, I spend, or back when I was traveling, spent a lot of time in D.C., a lot of row houses there. My
sure.
friend John Setniff, when he was the fire chief in York, PA, they had a lot of row houses. And actually, I caught a fire with John one day when I was there visiting. And it made me think of some of the unique construction features of those. And I'm glad to see that NIOSH, they stuck some information there on tactics, on fire travel, and some other stuff. If you got row houses in your area, and a lot of the East Coast departments do, get up on NIOSH and look for that fact sheet and the poster on the fighting those row house fires. And I know where, if I was in an area where I had that hazard, those fact sheets would probably find their way to the bathroom about eye level when you're standing at the urinal, because that seemed to be the best way to get information out to the troops, because everybody's going to be in that little room at one point or another during the day.
You know, I it's interesting that NIOSH is doing that, because it's almost like everybody's getting into the act. You know, the old Jimmy Durant, everybody's got to get into the act. So it's interesting because, you know, UL, as we all know, UL, they took off. You know, Steve Kerber and company, you know, with their firefighter safety, all the testing that they're doing and all the good video and the good written word that they're putting out on strategy, tactics, and the way we needed to change some of that, along with some of the NIST stuff. Of course, when Dan Majakowski was there, and now he jumped ship to UL, he's working with Steve. But now, like, you know, NIOSH, I'm just trying to keep my head straight here. NIOSH is CDC, and they do the firefighter fatality reports, correct?
Correct.
They do the NIOSH reports, yeah. So I guess somebody must have sat back and said, you know, we've been writing fire fatality reports for 40 years. Maybe we should write something like positive, you know?
Yeah.
Because they do their investigations and they put out, you know, and they do a pretty decent job with the fatality reports. And a lot of fire academies use them. They have their probies or their rookies there while they're in school to pull up the reports and dig into what happened to those firefighters and do a presentation to the class, so to speak. And so they do a nice job, but you very rarely see anything coming out of NIOSH that's really positive in terms of strategy and tactics. And frankly, there's a lot of organizations and groups doing a lot of that stuff. So it's interesting to see NIOSH pop in with row house stuff. Of course, our good friend John McGrath spent 33 years in Philadelphia. I think the guys in Philly, I think they're the master of the row house fire, you know?
Yeah. You know, in fact, the NIOSH stuff is pretty much the basis of group exercises in the Academy's Infinite Safety Officer class. And I always encourage, you know, my guys, even if you're just sitting down around the kitchen table, pull up a NIOSH report and, you know, print it out, sit down, have everybody take a look at it, and start hashing out what the incident parameters were, as well as what the recommendations are. The sad portion of the show is the fact that the recommendations tend to repeat themselves, because
we're not finding
any new ways to kill ourselves. we're really tuned into the old stuff. But
you and I have had
the conversation about the importance of building construction, and right. I think you know the row house thing certainly lends itself to that. But I've confessed my sins that early on in my career, I didn't really pay that much attention to it. Of course, I wasn't worried about big strategic decision making and all that stuff on the fire ground. But I look back at the work that Glenn Corbett's done since he took over Frank Brannigan's book. And if you're going to have one book in your library, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Make sure it's the building construction for the fire service. I had
I was
poking around on Facebook a couple months ago, and I got an invite to join a group called Building Construction for the Fire Service. And that group's actually run by our good friend Rick DeGroot, retired Summit Deputy Chief.
And, well, how about that?
Rick's got some good stuff up on there. And if you're a Facebook social media kind of person, take a look at that. Building Construction for the Fire Service. It's not a lockdown group. Anybody can read the stuff that's on there. But there's some great photos and some good examples that Rick has passed on to everybody in the fire service.
You know, with all the different subjects of classes that I teach, I don't know why or how, but I get around to talking about construction, and I get around to talking about the book all the time. You know, I look at the young firefighters in the room. You know, men and women just starting out, whether they're volunteer or career, you know, it doesn't matter. And you know, I look at them and say, here's the book. Like you said, here's the one book you have to have in your library. You know, get this book. You know, because, you know, Frank Brannigan's thing was the building's your enemy. You have to know your enemy, you know, and that still rings true. And it's going to ring true 100 years from now, Tommy. That's never going to go away. You know, we talked about leaving legacies like Brunicini. Look at what Brannigan has done, you know, and what he preached.
Yeah.
You know, he preached for 55 years, you know, and for those of you who don't know, he's gone now. But he left his work. You know, and I think it's the fifth or sixth edition of the book already. And like you said, Glenn Corbett, our good friend from New Jersey, and Brainiac extraordinaire, kind of took over for Frank after he passed away. And thank God for guys like Corbett because, he's kind of one of the unsung heroes. I was very glad to see a few years ago that fire engineering gave him the lifetime achievement because he certainly has earned it, you know. And he's a guy I'm glad to call my friend because I met Glenn in the mid '80s, a long time ago, 35 years ago, and he's just a good dude all around. But there's very few people smarter than him in our business. I have him on speed dial, by the way.
Oh yeah.
whether I was working in the firehouse or where I'm working now. For the benefit of the audience, I've as most of you know, I left my last command a year and a half ago. I just started working in a 14 high-rise building interconnected complex. It's a medical center in Manhattan doing fire and life safety work. And, it's about a little over 5 million square feet. And I have Glenn Corbett on speed dial, so I encourage people to do that. And there's another guy. You know, he's brilliant, and he'll take your call, and he'll help anybody. I mean, he'll help. He did tons of work after the Trade Center went down in 2001. I mean, tons. He got calls from all kinds of groups, organizations. He was on the building investigation committee. This woman called her son died. It was a probie. Christian Reagan died in the building. It was a probie, and they started the campaign for skyscraper safety is what they called it. And he just, every committee and every report and every, he had his hand on it, you know? And so we're lucky to have guys like him around. And just people to get to know, but Brannigan's book, building construction. You can't say enough about it. It should be, if you're just starting out and you're new in the fire service and for some stupid reason you're listening to me and Tommy tonight, we can't believe you'd be listening to us. But again, you're starting your library. You know, that's the first book you're going to buy, Building Construction for the Fire Service by Francis L. Brannigan. And get the latest edition and read it more than once. Read it and understand. Because that's your biggest enemy as a structural firefighter is going to be the buildings. There's no doubt about it. But that's interesting to hear NIOSH has gotten into the game, you know.
Oh, yeah. So I came across another item, and it was talking about the Los Angeles Fire Department. And I didn't look real close as to where the fire had occurred, but they had evacuated the building, and then they sent the robot in. And the robot was credited with containing the fire after the evacuation, which, you know, if you look at the history of robotics in the fire service, there's been some interesting stuff out there. What really kind of got my goat was the media report referred to this as the first in the nation. And I'm here to tell you that is not true.
No, definitely not true.
I remember back in the early 70s. Reading an article, and I think it may have been a fire engineering article, but they talked about Rural Metro in Scottsdale, Arizona, was experimenting with robots. And they had this, like, track-driven deal that basically drug a 2.5 behind it.
Yeah, it was like a baby tank. It had, like, tank tracks, right?
Yeah.
I remember that. I actually remember that, Tom.
that gives me warm, fuzzy feelings that I wasn't hallucinating. But, you know...
Like, you probably were, but I remember that.
Yeah. But this robot that the LAFD was using is cool-looking. It's the Thermite RS-3. And it's got, all kinds of bells and whistles on it that the guys who were probably building this stuff in the 70s never dreamed of, with
right.
along the lines of thermal imaging. And, you know, if you look at the ordnance disposal guys and some of the intricate work that they can do with robots now in that hazardous operation, maybe it's time, you know.
Yeah, they used them on the Notre Dame fire when the church was burning.
I saw that.
Remember? Yeah.
Yeah.
They used it on the Notre Dame fire. So this stuff has been around. It's just not popular, you know. But the technology's been around for a long time. I remember that tanky looking thing with the 2.5 on it. You know, and it's listen. It has to be conditions have to be not perfect, but. You know, it's got to be right where that device can kind of even with its tracks can get over, you know, debris and all that kind of stuff. You know, and or you, to me, you got an underground fire. You know, like a parking deck below ground, and it's you know it's rocking and rolling. You send that baby down the ramp, you know, and see what happens. You know, so
yeah.
And if you had to, you can adapt it, put foam on air and stuff. So it probably has some industrial applications, I'm thinking, you know.
So I was looking at Billy's firefighter close calls the other day, there was a post on there that kind of piqued my interest. And I think back to a lot of the stuff that happened to me early in my career. And there was a battalion chief in Millburn, a guy by the name of Jack Ross. And Jack was a real no-nonsense, kind of crusty old battalion chief. And Billy had a video posted on Close Call that was titled No BS on My Fireground. And a lot of it had to do with... at least in my mind, one of the things that I tend to preach is radio discipline, and,
right.
as well as talking about command presence. And if you haven't seen this video, go up on Billy's website. It was posted back on the 31st of December, and it's called No BS on My Fireground. It is about a 15-minute video but it is definitely worth the watch. You could tell this guy's running the fire.
No doubt in anybody's mind?
No, and especially after about 10 minutes into the video. He was telling a company officer that this is not a discussion. Get up on the roof now.
Interesting. I get the secret list, and I kind of breezed through it, you know. But I did see that no BS on my fire ground. At that moment, I wasn't in the mood for tuning in. But now you're piquing my interest, so I'm gonna have to listen to it.
Yeah, go back and take a look at it. It's actually a great piece of video. Hey,
what year is it? Modern era or is it old?
Oh no, it's probably within the last month or so.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Gotcha.
So Nashville, what a mess.
Yeah, no kidding.
I haven't heard anything. What little bit I have heard was this may be related to an issue that Bomber had with AT&T.
I heard the same thing, that it was something with the phone company.
And something to do with 5G. I don't understand that stuff enough to give you an opinion as to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But, you know, thank God for small favors that he didn't take out a bunch of people while pulling that off.
Yeah, no kidding. No, that could have been very bad on a busy Saturday afternoon or whatever, you know. But it appears from his rantings and all this other stuff, he didn't want to hurt anybody. He just wanted to do damage, you know, and be famous or something. So whatever. He doesn't get any kudos to me, but yeah, thank God nobody got hurt.
Now, if you look at there's some interesting video on that. And, you know, you and I have talked about response to violent incidents. And I think, and I got to give kudos to the cops in Nashville when they got out there and realized that there was a voice coming out of the van telling them to get ready. And God only knows how many lives they saved by evacuating the nearby buildings. And some of that. But, you know, sometimes, you know, especially out here, and I'm not in complete rural America anymore right now, but we're still, you know, pretty isolated out here. And we tend to get complacent with some of that stuff. But, man, it's all situational awareness and paying attention to what's going on around us and trying to be cognizant of the stuff out there that has the potential to really kill us.
Well, you know, Tom, it because incidents like that are far and few between, I don't think the fire service has an edge. I don't think that we have that edge that, you know, the guys in Nashville, that's like in the firehouse. That's the last thing. The very last thing they were thinking was that a bomb would go off in the middle of the street downtown, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, if you go to Tel Aviv or Haifa, they're on the edge, you know, because it happens, you know. So it's not on the front burner with the American Fire Service. I don't know if it needs to be, but I think that you know, you have to have the knowledge, you have to have the recognition of it and all that other stuff to realize what it could be, you know. So the thing for me is, where do you draw the line, and how prepared? I mean, we always talk about, you know, being as prepared as we can be and expect the unexpected and all that good stuff. But I mean, that's just not on our radar, you know. Especially his you know, just a guy who's got a beef with the telephone company, nothing to do with anything else. You know, and so I'm not sure how prepared we are for that, and how much of that thought process that we have upon arrival, you know.
Yeah, which tends to segue into the next item I wanted to kind of talk about the anniversary of, and a sad situation of the fire that occurred on December 24th in 2012 in West Webster, New York. Something we can't forget about. And the two guys that got killed, Thomas, I know I'm going to mispronounce this.
Yeah, go ahead. Try it, big fella. Try it. It's 14 consonants, I know. Try it. I think it was like, was it Tremazowitz? Does that sound right?
It's Krakzowka, I think is how it's, at least the way it looks. And then Michael Chaparini, I believe.
Chaparini, yep.
Yeah, Chaparini. He was a police officer and a volunteer firefighter.
Yes, I remember.
But they
that.
Were both shot and killed at the scene of a car fire. And again, I don't know whether there were any clues there to tune them into the fact that there was something really bad going on and going to happen.
And I don't think that and one of them being a cop. You pull up with your volunteer fire company on a car fire. You know, nobody in this United States or maybe most of the world would think that there's a guy laying for you behind a grassy knoll with a high-powered rifle. I mean, there's just no way.
Yeah.
Tommy, think of all the fires you've been to in the last 40 years and tell me that was on your mind when you pulled up. It's not.
No.
It's not. It was never on mine either. It's different if you get the call and saying, you know, you're going to an active shooter or you're going to this or, you know, there's a suspect on it, whatever. You know, you got a fire with a guy with a gun standing on the roof. That's a different story. Your antennas go up and you put your training into effect and you take your precautions. But it's going to, West Webster, New York, the town's just two blocks long. It's this little tiny hamlet upstate, way upstate New York. And you're going to a car fire on Christmas Eve, all right? Somebody's car were burnt down, and this guy was laying for them with a rifle. I mean, there's no way that's going to be ever on your radar. It's not going to be there. Should it? I don't know. Maybe you got to get off the rig and do a scan of. You got to do a 360 scan and see if everything looks fairly normal. And then even then you don't know, because if the guy, you know, if somebody's, you know, hiding or laying in wait and going to give you 5 minutes to get set up, then you say, all right, we're good. And then he pops out from behind a tree. I mean, it's sad to think about it and to talk about it. But I remember, Tom, the West Webster guy showing up at the memorial, the annual memorial in Emmitsburg.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was almost a year later. You know, it happened in December and then our ceremonies in October. And they still had that look on their face, man. They still had that look. I remember walking over to two or three, and I'm like, I saw their patch. That was one of the years we were indoors because of the weather. We were over at the Mount St. Mary's in the arena. And I said, how you guys doing? You know, how's your recovery going? And they said, it's going slow. So I shook their hands, and I wished them good luck. And I said, thank you. We're glad you're here. And there's no better way to honor your guys than to be here today. And I kept going because, you know, as you know, we have 10,000 other things going on with our memorial that weekend. And we don't forget, but I'm not, and there's lessons learned and all that other stuff, but there's nobody, there's no fire company in these United States, I'm making a prediction here, that gets off the rig at a fire and looks around and thinks there's somebody waiting for them with a gun. I mean, it's just not. You know, you go there with all good intentions to do your job and get out of there, a career volunteer or otherwise. You know, and so I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I really don't know. But you know, as long as we kind of talked about the memorial, for those of you who don't know, not all politicians are bad, just most of them. But in a few weeks ago, in the middle of December, a former senator from Maryland passed away. His name was Paul Sarbanes, and the reason why I talk about Senator Sarbanes is he was a huge fire safety advocate and fire service advocate, and he was instrumental. He was instrumental in the formation and the development of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and getting the memorial on the campus in Emmitsburg. Sarbanes was a major player with the foundation and the memorial itself, and I just wanted to mention him He passed away. I think he retired from the Senate sometime in the middle '00s, around 2006, 2008. But he was at the ceremonies every year. When he was active and retired, he would come every year to hang out and be with the people who he loved and respected. But I just wanted to mention that he has passed. But there's another guy who did something good for humanity, for the fire service, and his stuff will go on for a long, long time. Just walking onto the campus in Emmitsburg and looking at the memorial, Sarbanes is one of the guys that put it there. So I just wanted to mention him. He was a 5-term senator out of Maryland. And currently, the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the Congressional Fire Service Institute join forces every year, and they award the Paul Sarbanes Award to an organization that promotes health and safety. So every year, I believe at the congressional dinner, they give a fire department or a group the Paul Sarbanes Award for promoting health and safety in their organization. So I just wanted to mention him and give him a little bit of kudos as he passed on to the other side, so to speak, like they say, you know. And very nice gentleman. I met him a bunch of times Memorial Weekend, and nice man to talk to and chat with.
Hey, did you see where Roger Birchfield from Indianapolis Fire passed away?
Was that the photographer?
Yes.
I'm going to take a wild guess that you probably knew him.
Yes.
Just a wild guess.
Yeah. Indy Fire's photographer and historian. And if there was a working fire in anywhere in Indy, you could guarantee he was gonna show up. He was a real icon at FDIC as well, doing a lot of photography during the event. Him and I could see his face. The other guy from Jersey,
Tony.
Tony, thank you. It's
Tony.
Fun getting old.
Can't think of his last name, but I call him Tony No Baloney. That's why. I never use his real name. I call him Tony No Baloney. So, Tony Bag of Donuts. Call him Tony Bag of Donuts.
Yeah. But Roger was definitely somebody you always saw around FDIC, or if you were buffing in the Indy area, definitely run into. And just rest in peace, Roger, and my condolences to your family.
Yeah, some guys they leave their mark. There's another guy left his mark just by being a photographer and a historian. So, you know, just to talk about that for a moment, leaving your mark and legacies and stuff. Nobody plans to do that. Nobody says, I think I'm going to leave my legacy, or I think I'm going to be some guy that people are going to talk about, or I'm going to. It happens by itself. Nobody, you know, you could aim high. You could say, well, I want to be a chief, or I want to be, you know, I'm a firefighter. I want to be a deputy someday. I want to be chief of department. That's okay. Those are personal, professional goals and all that kind of stuff. But guys like, the list is long. You know, if you just look at the list of the lifetime achievement winners in the last 20 years from fire engineering.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll start with a couple: Jack Murphy, Jerry Tracy, Glenn Corbett, Dennis O'Neill, Ron Sarnicky, Ronnie Coleman, Donnie Mano, Vinnie Dunn, Ray Downey. And so these names should be pretty familiar to people who are listening to this show. And none of those people, and all the rest, John Eversole, and I'll think a couple as we go on in between, but none of those guys sat up one day and said, I'm going for that Lifetime Achievement Award. It's not in the thought process. It's you put your head down and you dedicate yourself to this profession of ours. And when I use the word profession, but you can be, you know, volunteer career otherwise. This is a profession no matter what. Doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with getting paid. And you contribute. It's about contributing. It's about, you know, and doing the right things at the right time for the right reasons and all of that stuff. It's kind of like a little formula, you know. And before you know it, you know, Rick Lasky, you're standing on stage at FDIC and they're handing you this nice trophy, a piece of marble, what do they call it, an obelisk piece of marble. Yes, looks like the Washington Memorial, the Washington Monument. I love it. And all of those guys, and I've spoken to all of them. I knew all of them. Or the ones that passed, I knew, and the ones who didn't, I know. And I say to them, what's going through your mind? And they said, I have no idea how I got here. They all say the same thing. I can't believe they picked me. I don't understand why I'm worthy. Like, it's that old thing from that movie. I'm not worthy. We're not worthy. That stupid comedy picture that I didn't see, but I know the line because everybody uses it. But it's like, how'd they pick me? I'm just a guy who, put my head down and charged forward and put my, shoulder to the wheel, nose to the grindstone thing. So all of those people, and the thing is, for the folks listening, if you're brand new in the business or you've been around longer than 20 minutes like me and Tommy, it's about really, I think it all comes down to contributing. It's about contributing to the cause. Anybody can sit around and sit back, and as our good friend Tony Castros would say, you could be a recliner sniper for 30 years, just sitting in the recliner and shoot everything that comes into the room, including your training officer, your chief or whatever. But when you contribute, that's how those moments arrive. Just contribution. Whether it's writing, whether it's training, whether it's it just happens. I'll also tell the folks that are listening, when we get back to FDIC, and God willing, we will get back this year in April. all of those folks are extremely approachable and extremely humble. I always told my favorite story was about Ray Downey. Ray was an icon bigger than life. He was the captain of Rescue 2 in Brooklyn in its heyday. There was no better fireman and commander and the most decorated guy who ever hit the New York City Fire Department. His Class A jacket with the medals on it weighed about 350 pounds. Okay, Ray was almost hunchback when he used to wear his coat. But at FDIC, you'd see him in the booth talking to like the chief from Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles. He'd be in like the fire engineering booth, sitting on a couch talking to the chief from LA. And you walk by an hour later and he's talking to a 20-year-old volunteer from Kentucky and giving that kid the same half hour he gave to the other guy.
Yeah.
And all of those guys that I mentioned, Corbett and O'Neill and Murphy and whoever else stood up there and got a lifetime achievement, they will and would do the same exact thing. So, I'm fortunate. I teach a workshop every year at FDIC. I'm going to be doing another one in 2021. And I tell, and those are the beginning of the week. The workshops are the beginning of the week. I asked who the first timers are. They raised their hand. I said, the people who you read in the magazine are all going to be here. Find them, seek them out, and bring your questions. And they will be happy to sit and talk to you. I don't care who it is. Everybody's approachable. Oh, that guy is a New York City fire guy. It's John Salk. Nicest guy in the world. And I encourage them to seek out those people because the next guy or gal, and I guess eventually they're going to pick a woman for that honor. It's coming, so that's okay. Is sitting in the audience. It's a participant because all of those other guys, they kind of went to FDIC for 20, 30, 40 years, and wrote articles and whatever. And so I remember John Eversole specifically saying that. John was pretty choked up when he got his award. And most of the guys get emotional. And he said, the next recipient of this award is sitting in this audience today. And I think John Norman said it too. So, you concentrate on leaving a legacy. You don't concentrate on becoming the go-to person or the recognized talking head. It happens because I think it's through contributions. That's kind of my thing. Wow, we got off on a little tangent there, didn't we?
That's all right.
Let me see.
Hey,
go ahead. You got something, buddy?
Yeah, I mean, as I look at, what a fire service history guy I am. And December is a bad month for us. I go back and look at December 22nd of 99 of what occurred in Keokuk, Iowa, where we lost three guys and three kids who perished in a fire in that small community. But, you know, when I talk about learning the lessons that these guys left for us, here's another great training opportunity to go and look at the NIST fire simulation that Madrakowski put together on this fire, as
I've
well as
that.
The NIOSH report. Here's another great training opportunity. Unfortunately, we go back to December 3rd of 1999 in Worcester, Mass.
Right.
And Thomas Spencer, Paul Brotherton, Tim Jackson, Jeremiah Lucy, James Lyons, and Joseph McGurk all made the supreme sacrifice in that cold storage warehouse. Go back and look and see what happened. Look at the line of duty death reports and look at the recommendations in there. These guys did not die in vain. They left a legacy for us to look at and to see what's going on. If you want to go even further back, we can go back to December 1st of 1958 of the Lady of Angels school fire in Chicago. And Billy's actually got a post up on Close Calls that he put up back on November 30th that's got some great footage on that.
But I saw that. I saw that.
If you want to talk about the fire that made the turnaround in code enforcement and development in schools, that's the fire that did it.
That's the one.
That's the one. Much like the Triangle Shirtwaist fire did it in New York City. This was a biggie. And, of course, always the one that's near and dear to my heart, being kind of a history buff, was December 7th of 1941 when the Honolulu Fire Department lost three guys. And I think I sent you the article, Ron, called The Day the Honolulu Fire Department Went to War. One of my favorite reads. But if you look at John Coretta, Thomas Macy, and Harry Pang, who made the supreme sacrifice during that attack, I think they were the first three and probably the only three civilian firefighters that were awarded the Purple Heart by the United
States. Yeah, I think there were six guys that got wounded, and they got Purple Hearts. So that group of firemen were the only civilians that got Purple Hearts, I think, in the history of the military. Because I think the three guys that got killed and the six guys that got hurt. But, you know, Tom, you know, you talk about Worcester, Mass., you know, and then Keokuk happened a week or two later. And Keokuk, people were still reeling from the Worcester fire. Because it was six guys, and the fire was so big, and the Keokuk didn't quite get what they call they didn't quite get the headline, so to speak. Now, you know, almost immediately I had met Mark Wessel, the chief in Keokuk, and you want to talk about a fire taking a toll on a human being? He was never the same. He got a little bit active with the foundation for a while, then he retired, and then he just kind of went away, man. But you talk about having an effect on a person. That did it on this guy.
That's the stuff that nightmares are made out of. Can you imagine being the incident commander and having a guy and come out and hand you a kid that is not breathing and is probably in cardiac arrest, and the only thing you can... I couldn't imagine having to make that decision. He had to throw that himself and the kid into a police car, and off they went to the hospital. Now, the stuff that transpired after the command presence disappeared is truly tragic, but I will never second-guess anybody for making a decision that hard. Man, it's and there, but for the grace of God, I never had to deal with anything like that.
Yeah, me neither. Me neither. And he was a little bit, you know, there were certain camps that chastised him for leaving the scene, and he had to deal with that. You know, you left your men in a burning house, you know, without any direction or any command, you know. And meanwhile, he's got a half dead kid in his arms, and he looks at the cop. He says, "We got to go," you know. So
yeah.
And of course, the building came down and killed three of his guys with three kids in the house. So, but didn't quite get the headline as Worcester did, you know. And of course, you know, one of the Worcester guys, Jerry Lucy, was cousins with Dennis Leary, who's a famous comic and actor now from Rescue Me and all that. So that kind of elevated the fire a little bit more. But it's interesting, Tom, but December has been, for some reason, a traditionally horrendous month for firefighters. And while we did lose a few guys this past December, we didn't have that horrific December this year. And I was just, you know, every year we get to December 1 and I just pray a little bit harder, you know, because we always talk every year, it rolls around and we say, God, you know, not this year, you know, God, you know, we have a bad December every single year. You know, West Webster was Christmas Eve, for crying out loud. And there were guys killed on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and six guys in Worcester, and it goes on and on the list. So while we had some tragedy, it wasn't a typical December for us. And God, I'm so thankful for that. You know what? I don't know what to say. I mean, it's maybe we're just getting better, and maybe we're paying attention more, and maybe we, you know, but you know, talk about getting better. You know, you mentioned Worcester. I don't know if you remember, Tommy, but within a couple of months of that fire, they had the same exact fire in Jersey City. Right near the mouth of the Holland Tunnel, on the Jersey City side, right by the Holland Tunnel. If you're going into the tunnel, off the Skyway, the building was to the left. The building was to the left.
I can see that.
And in 1999-2000, I was still a chief in New Jersey, and I knew Chief Eggers. I can't remember his first name. I remember his last name, believe it or not. Eggers Eggers. And he had the fire. I mean, that was his, and it was a couple of months later. and of course, after Worcester, they looked at that cold storage warehouse in Jersey City. And then sure enough, they get it. And they went there prepared based on the lessons learned from losing six guys in Massachusetts. So they didn't die in vain, as you would say. Those guys didn't, because they saved countless other guys, it turns out, in New Jersey in that particular case. So the lesson learned for people listening to the show is, you know, Tommy always reads the roll call at the end of the show of our line of duties, and he says, you know, let's heed the lessons learned. There's something to be learned from every single line of duty death and major fire in the history. You know, Tom talked about the Lady of Angels fire being, which turned the tide for the codes for schools. There's never been a multiple fatality fire in a school since Our Lady of Angels in the United States. But think about that. Think about that.
Yeah.
We had this horrendous fire, killed boatload of kids, a bunch of nuns. It was a Catholic school. And since that fire, we haven't had I don't know if we had a fatality of a student in a fire in a school at all. Since when was the fire? 58? 58.
Yeah,
so 58. Talk about changing. Talk about stemming the tide through lessons learned. Okay, here we are. It's 62 years later. We haven't lost a kid in a school from a fire, you know. So sometimes it works. Sometimes we can pull them lessons and do something with it, you know. Well, Thomas, it is 8:25 here in New York, and did you get a chance to put the roster together?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so why don't you let's honor our fallen, and then we'll say goodnight. Go ahead, buddy.
The last time we were on was November 23rd. That was our last show for 2020. I do need to point out that according to the statistics on the U.S. Fire Administration's website, we suffered 91 line-of-duty deaths in 2020. And on November 27th, Alan Brasso from Calumet, Washington, passed away from a heart attack after a call. On December 6th, David Tomlinson from Poinette, Wisconsin, passed away from COVID. December 9th, Donald Downs from Nauvoo, Alabama, also a COVID death. December 10th, Leo Werner from Scales Mound, Illinois, heart attack after a call. December 11th, Robert Orkes from Shepherdsville, Kentucky, a COVID death. 12/11, Lee Whitman from Harrisburg, PA, a COVID death. 12/16, Edward Hine, also from Harrisburg, PA, another COVID death. These guys were from the same fire company and had been longtime members of the fire company and passed away within a week of each other. December 17th, Randy Robinson from Fort Worth, Texas, a COVID death. December 24th, Andrew Davis from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, a COVID death. And the last line of duty for the year was on 12/27. Logan Young from Martinsburg, Virginia. Logan was a firefighter with the Air National Guard, and they had gone in on a structure fire, mutual aid, a barn fire, and was struck by a beam and lost his life in that incident. The COVID numbers continue to climb, and I pray to God that this vaccine is going to help some of this, because it's just bad stuff. And I'm hoping that the answer is here, and that we kind of heed that lesson and let's get ourselves healthy.
Yeah, what you said, because right now, as most of the folks listening know, Tommy and I are intimately involved with the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and we couldn't have our ceremony in October this year, but we're heading for Emmitsburg this coming October, and we're going to have a 2-year ceremony for the 2019 and the 2020 line of duties, and then we're going to add to that. It appears the federal government, in a lot of cases through the states, are recognizing the COVID deaths as line of duty, as well as the cancer deaths. In there's 38 states that recognize cancer as a cause of a line of duty. So we could be well up into the 250 name arena to have our main ceremony on Sunday, and on a 250 line of duties where we're normally doing 90 and 110, and you know, from years past and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to have a heavy lift in October, but who better to carry that burden than the people who are here to help those families get some closure and get back to normal. So keep an eye on the NFFF website. Keep an eye on what's going on with COVID, and you know, there were firefighters who said that they're not going to take the shot necessarily and all that stuff, but this is real. You know, 350,000 fatalities across the country, and our own people, you know, just a whole batch of our own people succumbing to this thing. In fact, I saw just the other day when I worked in Eastern Connecticut for the Mohegan Tribal Fire Department, the deputy chief in the town of Monville, which is where the reservation is, and his wife died from COVID. So it's becoming that thing like cancer. Everybody knows somebody, you know. So take care of yourselves. Take care of yourselves. Be safe. I'm not going to do my usual litany tonight. Be safe. If you got a chance to get that vaccine, you should probably look at it seriously. And let's all hope and pray we can get together at FDIC this year and see each other in person. So with that, I'm going to say goodnight, Tom, and wish everybody a happy, healthy, and safe new year. And I think we're done.
All right, my brother.
All right, Tommy, we'll talk to you soon. Yep.
And everybody stay safe.
Take care, everybody. Good night. Come on, music. Don't you want to play?